Going to do this right. No shortcuts.
23. I leave the library on shaky legs, heart racing like I'm 40 minutes deep into spin class. I've gone hours without checking my phone, and the usual emails have accumulated, one from my boss, who rarely honors the concept of the weekend, and a slew from clients who feel similarly, along with a string of texts from Libby. I squint against the sunlight to see the pictures she sent of the progress she made today. The Good Books Cafe now looks snug and cozy, and the window display of summer favorites is lined in twinkly lights. In most of the pictures, Sally stands off to one side, beaming, but in one wonky shot that includes a good portion of someone's thumb, Libby stands with arms flung wide and a huge smile on her face, silky pink bun lopsided atop her head. Her heart-shaped face looks more or less the same as when she was 14 years old and got accepted into the high school art show. Proud, confident, capable. Even with all the weirdness between us, it makes me so happy to see her like that. Looks amazing, I tell her. You're a wunderkind. Can't even tell it's the same place. Thanks, she replies. Everything all right? Not like you to be late. I was supposed to meet her at Papa Squat's 10 minutes ago. I type back, all good, be there in a minute. I just have a call to make first. I stop at one of the green benches along the street, the metal hot from baking in the sun, and dig through my purse for the phone number Shepard gave me. Maybe it's old school of me to follow up with someone to let him know I'm not interested, but Shepard's a nice guy. He deserves better than long-form ghosting. The line rings 3 times before someone picks up, a woman's voice saying, "Dan Topkins and Morrow, how may I help you?" After a second of confusion, I say, I'm looking for Shepard? I'm sorry, she says. There's no one here by that name. Who is this? I say. This is Tyra, she says, at the law offices of Dent, Hopkins, and Morrow. I must have the wrong number. I hang up and feel around in my purse until I find a receipt with chicken scratch numbers on it. This is the one Shepard gave me. The number I just called must have been the one Sally gave me. For your sister, I dug up the number she asked for. I could use some food to soak up the gallon of coffee I drank today, but it's not just over-caffeination making my hands shake as I type the name of the law office into a Google search. When the results appear, it's like someone injected ice into my veins. Dent, Hopkins, and Morrow, family law attorneys. Libby asked Sally for the number of a divorce lawyer? For an instant, the street, the stone walkway, the pale blue sky, the world feels like it's being shredded into ribbons. My lungs are overinflated, something large and heavy blocking anything from getting in or out. I'm back in our old apartment, in those terrible weeks after Mom died, watching Libby fall apart, holding her tight while she sobs until she can't breathe, until she's gagging. I'm drowning in her pain, my own hardening, calcifying into my heart. I don't want to be alone, she sometimes gasps, or else, we're alone, we're all alone, Nora. I'm holding her tight, burying my mouth in her hair and promising she's wrong, that she'll never be alone. I have you, I tell her. I'll always have you. All those nights, I jarred awake and found it all still there waiting for me. Mom gone, no money, Libby breaking. Sometimes she cried in her sleep. Other times I woke while she was in the bathroom and the cold spot in the bed beside me sent me into a panic. In those days, pain waited like a shadowy monster, towering over our bed, and instead of shrinking night by night, it grew, feeding on us, getting fat with our grief. Early one morning, we lay wrapped under the blankets, and I smoothed my sister's strawberry hair, and she whispered, I just don't want to be here anymore. I want it to stop. And that same cold panic grew too big for my body, swelling, throbbing angrily. Without thinking about money or work or school or any of the millions of practicalities for which I'd become responsible, I said, then let's go somewhere. And we did. Bought round trip, middle of the week, red eye tickets to Los Angeles. Checked into a seedy motel whose deadbolt didn't work and wedged the desk chair under the knob while we slept each night. Every morning, we took a cab to the beach and stayed there until dinner, always something cheap and greasy. We took some of Mom's ashes and dumped them in the ocean when no one was looking, then ran away, shrieking and laughing, unsure whether we'd just broken a law. Later, we'd split the rest of the ashes between the East River and the Hudson, bits of Mom on either side of our city, hemming us in, holding us. But we weren't ready to let go of that much of her yet. For one whole week, Libby didn't cry. And then, on the plane home, during takeoff, she looked out the window, watching the water shrink beneath us, and whispered, "When will it stop hurting?" "I don't know," I told her, knowing she'd see I was lying, that I believed it would never stop, not ever. She descended into ugly, wrenching sobs, and the other passengers shot tired glares in our direction. I ignored them, pulled Libby into my chest. "Let it out, sweet girl," I murmured, just like Mom used to say to us. A flight attendant either overestimated our ages or took pity on us and discreetly dropped off two miniature liquor bottles. Through her hiccups, Libby chose the Baileys. I drank the gin. Ever since that day, I couldn't so much as smell it without thinking about holding tight to my sister, about missing Mom so much that she felt closer than she had in weeks. Maybe that's why it's the only thing I really drink. Feeling that hole in your heart is better than feeling nothing at all. I blink clear of the memory, but the pain in my chest, the ache deep in my hands, don't let up. I sink onto the hot metal of the bench and count out the seconds of my inhalations, matching them to my exhalations. That was the last trip Libby and I took. It was the last trip I've taken, period, aside from that one ill-fated weekend in Wyoming with Jacob. Once I got our debt under control, I started setting aside money here and there so I could take Libby somewhere amazing, like Milan or Paris when she graduated from college. Once, she had all kinds of ambition, but after we lost Mom, it seemed like that all dried up. She stopped helping out at Freeman's and cycled through a few other potential career paths, but none of them held her attention. I spent her college years over her shoulder, pushing her, reading her essays for her, making her flashcards. We fought more than before, our new roles chafing on us, her endless grief warping from anger to exhaustion and back again. Sometimes, even years later, she still cried in her sleep. And then she met Brendan, and she decided not to finish school. When she told me they were engaged, I wasn't surprised. All I could think about was that teenage girl, terrified of being alone. I worried that she was too young, that she was making the decision more out of a need for security than because it was what she wanted deep down. But the truth is, she seemed happy. For the first time in years, I had my sister back. Brendan settled her. I didn't like that she'd given up the event planning job I'd pulled strings to get her, but the hunted look left my sister's eyes, and I could finally breathe. For years, she was finally okay, and all the work, all the missed birthday parties, all the early morning meetings, all the relationships that never got off the ground because of my schedule, it was all so fucking worth it. She was okay. Now, she's dodging her husband's calls and talking to a divorce attorney, spending 3 weeks away from him. And maybe that's why it suddenly matters so much that I'm a workaholic. Not because Libby doesn't approve, but because she needs me. She needs me, and I haven't been there. Fear rips through me as violent as a wildfire, but ice cold. Hidden there, under my rigidly manufactured sense of control and my checklists and my steel exterior, there is always fear. Libby was wrong when she told Sally I am just like Mom. Mom worked nonstop to chase something she wanted. For me, it's running endlessly trying to escape the past. Fear of the money running out again, of hunger, of failure, of wanting anything badly enough that it will destroy me when I can't have it, of loving someone I can't hold on to, of watching my sister slip through my fingers like sand, of watching something break that I don't know how to fix. I am afraid, always, of the kind of pain I know we won't survive a second time. I focus on the pressure of the ground beneath my soles, digging myself into place. One by one, action items slide into a tidy column in my mind. Find the best divorce lawyer money can buy. Find Libby an apartment she can afford on her own, or else one we can share with the girls. Could we all fit in Charlie's rent-stabilized place? Get a counselor to help her through this. Possibly hire a hitman. Or maybe not a hitman, but at least someone who can exact minor revenge. Drinks thrown in Brendan's face, keys dragged up the side of his car, depending on what exactly happened, hard as it is to imagine him doing anything but staring lovingly at Libby while rubbing her swollen feet. And then, the final item on the list, and the most immediate. Bring Libby as much happiness as possible right now. Make her feel safe enough to open up to me. My shoulders drop back into place. My lungs relax. Now that I know what's wrong, I can fix it. You know you can tell me anything, I say. Right? Libby looks up from the mayo ketchup mixture we've been dipping our Papa Squat's fries in and snorts.
Dude, she says flatly. Not this again. Focus on your own life, sissy.
Rather than throwing a barb back, I let it go. What's next on the list? She relaxes.
I'm glad you asked because I have an amazing idea.
How many times do I have to tell you? I say. A water park made out of alcohol is not a good idea.
Agree to disagree.
She swipes her hands together, dusting the salt off her fingertips.
But that's not what I'm talking about. I figured out how to save the bookstore.
How many bronze statues can one town square have?
A ball, Libby says. A blue moon ball, like in Once.
I feel my brow creasing. Is there even a blue moon this month?
Not the point.
Right, because the point is...
A huge fundraising opportunity, she says. Sally knows someone who owns an events company. He can get us a dance floor and a sound system, and then we get volunteers to decorate and bring pies for a bake sale. We do the whole thing out in the town square, just like in the book.
This is a lot of work, I say hesitantly.
We won't be doing it alone, she insists. Sally already put out calls to everyone in her wine exchange, and Amaya will work the bar, and Gertie,
the anarchist barista, I clarify,
offered to make flyers for us to spread around Asheville. Mug and Shot will turn into a pop-up soda fountain. Plus, they already have a liquor license, so they can do a couple of hard soda drinks. Half the town's already on board.
She snatches my hand against the sticky bar.
It'll be a piece of cake. A piece of pie, really. The only thing is...
Uh-oh, I say at her wince.
It's fine if we can't make it happen, she says quickly. But Sally and I thought it would be cool to do a virtual Q&A with Dusty, and then maybe have some signed stock on hand for her to promote, only if she wouldn't mind, and only if you don't mind asking her.
She presses her palms together, begging or praying. This is how you want to spend the next 2 weeks, I say, skeptical. Not resting, not reading and watching movies and lying out in the sun?
Desperately.
Whether it's a distraction, or a way for her to exercise control, or a chance to try a new life, this is what she wants. So, this is what she gets. I'll ask Dusty. Libby throws her arms around my neck, kissing my head a dozen times over.
We're doing it! We're saving a local business!
I'm not convinced, but she's happy, and Libby's happiness has always been my drug of choice. 24.
of course, Dusty says, in her dusty way, at once a bit hyperactive and vaguely spacey. I'd love to help, Nora, but I've never actually been to Sunshine Falls. I just happened to drive through years ago. Well, the people here love your book, I say. I glance back toward the side of the cottage, where Libby's stretched out in a picnic blanket, sunning herself whilst eavesdropping. She flashes me two encouraging thumbs up, and I clear my throat into the phone and go on. The whole town has these plaques about different parts of the story. It's really cute.
Really cute?
She repeats these words with awe, probably because they sound like an ancient Latin curse coming out of my mouth. My voice wrenches higher.
Yep.
I feel out of sorts asking a client for a favor, especially since it requires admitting I am here, working in person with Charlie. Dusty is shocked to hear I've left the city, and when I explain I came here with my sister, she is nearly as shocked to learn I have a sibling. As it turns out, all my longest-standing client really knows about me is I never leave New York, and I'm always reachable by phone. So, after some backstory, I fill her in on the plight of good books and lay out the plan for the fundraiser, an online book club with Dusty herself, open to any and all who order a book from the shop.
It's an hour of my life, she says. I think I can make it work for the world's best agent.
Have I told you lately you're my favorite client? I say.
You've never told me that, she replies. But you have sent me some very expensive champagne over the years, so I figured.
When edits for Frigid are done, I'm sending you a swimming pool of champagne. Libby straightens up on her blanket and points a finger at me. See? Alcohol water park, she mouths victoriously, then pitches herself onto her feet and thunders inside to call Sally with the good news. Yesterday, I broke down and texted Brendan to ask if something was going on between them, and he simply didn't reply, but I'm trying not to focus on that.
Can I ask you something, Dusty? I say.
Of course, ask away, she says.
Why Sunshine Falls?
She stops and thinks.
I guess, she says, it just seemed like the kind of place that might look one way on the outside and be something totally different once you got to know it. Like, if you had the patience to take the time to understand it, it might be something beautiful.
Sally, Gertie, Amaya, and a slew of other semi-familiar faces are in and out of the shop over the next few days, prepping for the ball. Finally, I'm able to concentrate on my work. Libby, meanwhile, is at the center of the planning whirlwind, constantly coming and going, loudly taking phone calls until other customers' disgruntled looks send her into an apology tailspin on her way out the door. Charlie and I mostly work over email. If we're in the same room for too long, I'm positive that Libby, and maybe even Sally, will know exactly what's going on, and complicated will be here fast. I've been taking Libby's disapproval of Charlie at her word, but now a part of me wonders if it's something else. If me using the dating apps was a sort of soft launch for her, just to see what's out there. Either way, I don't need to put this fling on display when she's dealing with her own relationship's implosion. My stomach roils every time I let myself think about it. But honestly, Charlie's and my email correspondence is the picture of professionalism. Our texts are not, and sometimes I have to sneak out of Libby's pop-up war room in the cafe to read them someplace where no one can see me flush. Half the time Charlie intercepts me, and we sneak around the shop, stealing seconds alone whenever we can get them. The bathroom hallway, the children's book room, the dead end in the nonfiction aisle, places where we're out of sight but still have to be nearly silent. Once he pulls me through the back door into the alleyway behind the shop, and we have our hands on each other before the door swings shut.
You look like you haven't slept in years,
I whisper. His palms roam down to my ass, hoisting me against him, and he drops his mouth beside my ear.
I've had a lot on my mind.
His hands range up me, testing each curve.
Let's go somewhere.
Where?
Anywhere that my mother and your sister aren't within eyeshot, he says. Or earshot.
I glance back at the door, in the general direction of Libby and Company's 1,000-point whiteboard checklist. All those little superglued cracks in my heart pulse with pain, a sensation like emotional brain freeze. I want this, him, but I can't forget what I'm doing here. I look back into his honeycomb eyes, feeling like I'm sinking waist deep into them, like there's no hope of getting away, in part because I lack any motivation while his hands are on me.
Anywhere?
I ask.
Name it.
Libby's so immersed in work mode, she doesn't insist on joining our Target run, and instead forks over the fundraiser's shopping list. Sally agrees to run the register if anyone comes in, and we set out in the old beat-up Buick Charlie's borrowing while he's in town. The air conditioning doesn't work, and the sun beats down on us hard, the blazing hot, grass-scented wind ripping my hair free from its tie strand by strand. All of this just makes the cool blast of air and clean, plasticky smell of Target more pleasant. I didn't think we'd been spending an inordinate amount of time outside, but in the surveillance cameras at the self-checkout, my skin looks browned. Libby-esque freckles are dappled across my nose, and the humidity has given my hair a slight wave. Charlie catches me studying myself and teases,
"Thinking about how hot and expensive you look?"
"Actually," I grab the receipt, "I'm daydreaming about how hard I'm about to work you." His eyes spark.
"I can take it."
We drive straight to the cottage, and as soon as we step into the cool quiet, I'm keenly aware that this is, realistically, the most alone Charlie and I have ever been. But we don't have long until Libby will be here, and there are, ostensibly, more important things to focus on than the places that Sweat has his shirt clinging to him.
"You can get started out back," I say, and head for the stairs to gather the rest of what we'll need.
By the time I kick open the back door, arms loaded with bedding, Charlie's already got the tent set up.
"Well," I say, "you've done it. You've surprised me."
"And here I thought that if you needed to stun a shark, you were supposed to just smack it between the eyes."
"No," I say, "competency with portable shelters is the way to do it." He crouches inside the tent and starts unrolling the air mattress we bought at Target, because, sure, Libby and I are going to camp, but we're still Stephen's women.
"How are you such a pro at this?" I ask.
"I camped a lot with my dad growing up."
The intense daylight has every sharp line of his face shadowed to black, his eyes more molasses than honey.
"Have you gone since you've been back?" I ask.
Charlie shakes his head. After a few seconds, he says,
"He doesn't want me here."
His tone, his brow, his mouth, everything about him has taken on that stony quality, like he's just reciting facts, objective truths that don't affect him.
"They weren't thrilled when I decided to stay in the city instead of coming back to work for one of them."
I wonder if people fall for that. If every time Charlie talks about the things that mean the most to him, the world sees a cold man with a clinical view of things, rather than someone grappling for understanding and control in a world where those rarely appear. I swallow the aching knot in my throat.
"I'm sure they want you here, Charlie. It sounds like that's what they wanted from the beginning."
He tips his chin toward the patio table, on which the extension cords we bought sit.
"Mind plugging in the air pump?"
For the next couple of minutes, we're silent as the pump howls. I set up the fans we pulled from the closet and plug them into the power strip. Charlie puts the bedding onto the mattress, and I hang the paper lantern lights, arranging the mosquito-repelling candles at regular intervals. We're quiet until I can't take it anymore.
"Charlie," I say,
and he looks over his shoulder at me, then turns to sit on the edge of the air mattress.
"I'm sure he's grateful you're here," I say. "They both must be."
He uses the back of his hand to catch the sweat on his brow.
When I told him I was staying for a while, his exact words were, "Son, just what do you think you can do?" The emphasis on you was his, not mine.
I sit on the deck in front of him, cross-legged. "But aren't you too close?"
"We were," he says. "We are. He's the best person I know. And he's right, there's not a lot I can do to help him. I mean, Shepard's the one keeping the business going, keeping up with the work their house always needs. All I can do is run the bookstore."
My heart stings. I remember that feeling of not being enough, of wanting so badly to be what Libby needed after we lost Mom and failing over and over again. I couldn't be tender for her. I couldn't bring the magic back into our life. All I had on my side was brute force and desperation. But I was trying to live up to a memory, the phantom of someone we'd both loved. Now I see what I missed before. Not just that Charlie never felt like he fit, but that he saw what it would have looked like if he did. I didn't make much of it at the time, but seeing Shepard standing with Clint at the salon, it isn't just that they are comparable heights and builds or the same trope. They look alike. The green eyes, the blonde hair, the beard. I climb into the tent beside him, the mattress dipping under my weight. "You're his son, Charlie." He runs his hands down his thighs, sighing.
"I'm not good at this shit."
He kneads his eyebrow, then leans back on the mattress, staring up through the mosquito-netted roof, a Charlie-suggested compromise that still counts as Libby and me sleeping under the stars.
"I've never felt so useless in my life. Things are falling apart for them, and the best I can do is open the store every day at the same time."
Which, from what you've told me, is a vast improvement. I move closer, his warm smell curling around me, the sun coaxing it from his skin. Overhead, spun sugar clouds drift across the cornflower blue sky. "You're not useless, Charlie. I mean, look at all this." He gives me a look.
"I know how to set up a tent, Nora. It's not Nobel worthy."
I shake my head. "Not that. You're..." I search for the right word. It's rare that my vocabulary fails me like this. "Organized." His eyes crackle with light as he laughs.
"Organized?"
"Extremely," I deadpan. "Not to mention thorough."
"You make me sound like a contract,"
he says, amused. "And you know how I feel about a good contract," I say. His smirk pulls higher.
"Actually, I only know how you feel about a bad one, written on a damp napkin."
He lies back fully on the mattress, and I do too, leaving a healthy gap between us. "A good contract is," I think for a moment.
"Adorable," Charlie supplies, teasing.
"No."
"Comely?"
"At bare minimum," I say.
"Charming?"
"Sexy as hell," I reply. "Irresistible. It's a list of great traits and working compromises that watch out for all parties involved. It's satisfying, even when it's not what you expected because you work for it. You go back and forth until every detail is just how it needs to be." I look sidelong at Charlie. He's already looking at me. The healthy gap has developed a fever. "What's the deal with Amaya?" It's out before I can second guess it. The corners of his mouth turn downward.
"What do you mean?"
"I mean," I say, "you almost married her. What went wrong?"
"A lot of things,"
he says. "Oh, like you were too forthcoming?" I tease. His lips draw into their smirk pout.
"Or maybe she just wasn't enough of a smartass for my taste."
After a beat, we turn our gazes back to the cotton candy soft clouds, and he says,
"We started dating in high school, and then she went to NYU, and after some time at community college, I followed her."
"Your first love, I guess." He nods.
"When we finished school, she wanted to look at places back in Asheville. It had never occurred to me that she'd want to move back, and it had never occurred to her that I wouldn't, and we were so bad at communicating that it didn't come up much.
Did you try long distance? I ask.
For a year, he says. Worst year of my life.
It never works, I agree.
Every day feels like a breakup, he says. You're constantly letting each other down or holding each other back. When we finally ended things, my mom was pretty brokenhearted. She told me I was making all the same mistakes she did, and I was going to end up alone if I didn't figure out my priorities.
She just wanted you to come back, I say, and Amaya was the fastest path.
Maybe.
He lets out a breath, like he's resigned himself to something.
We barely spoke for a few months, and then...
He hesitates.
I came home for the holidays, and I found out Amaya had been dating my cousin since a few weeks after we split. That's what she wanted to clear the air about the other night.
I sit up on my forearms, surprised. Wait, your ex-fiancé dated your cousin, Shepherd? He nods.
My family basically agreed not to tell me, but I found out anyway, and we had another rough stretch after that.
And there it is, another little piece of Charlie popped into place.
There aren't a ton of prospects here, he goes on. So I didn't exactly blame them, but at the same time...
Fuck that, I guess. He runs a hand up the backside of his head, then tucks it there.
I don't know. She deserves to be happy. Shepherd had a better chance of giving her that.
Why? I ask. He looks at me, brow pinched, like he doesn't understand the question. Why does he have any better chance at making someone happy than you do?
Oh, come on, Stevens,
he says wryly.
You of all people know what I mean.
I definitely don't, I insist.
Your archetypes, he says. The tropes. He's the guy every woman falls for. The son my parents wanted, working full-time at the job my dad wanted me to have, all while making, like, fucking rocking chairs in his spare time. He even went to my top choice for school.
Cornell, I say.
Went there to play football,
Charlie says.
But he's fucking smart, too. You went out with him. You know what he's like.
I did go out with him, I say, which is why I'm qualified to say you're wrong. I mean, not about him being smart, but the other thing, that he's more qualified to make someone happy. His smile fades. He looks back to the sky.
Yeah, well, he murmurs. At least for Amaya, it made sense. During our breakup, one of the last things she said to me was, if we stay together, every single day for the rest of our lives is going to be the same. Wasn't even the last time I heard that in a breakup speech.
He shakes his head.
Anyway, that's why she wanted to meet up, to apologize for how things ended.
I feel my cheeks coloring. It's cute of you to think that, Charlie, I say. But based on how she looks at you, I'm pretty sure all that sameness isn't so unappealing to her anymore.
It wasn't just that I was too boring for her. She also decided she wanted kids. Or I guess admitted she did, and was just waiting for me to change my mind.
I turn onto my side and face him. You don't?
I hated being a kid.
He folds his arm beneath his head and looks almost furtively in my direction.
I'd have no idea how to get someone else through it, and I definitely wouldn't enjoy it. I like them, but I don't want to be responsible for any.
Agreed, I say. I love my nieces more than anything on the planet, but every time Tala falls asleep in my lap, her dad gets all teary-eyed and is like, doesn't it just make you want to have some of your own, Nora? But when you have kids, they count on you. Forever. Any mistake you make, any failure. And if something happens to you... My throat twists. People like to remember childhood as all magic and no responsibilities, but that's not really how it is. You have absolutely no control over your environment. It all comes down to the adults in your life, and I don't know.
Every time Libby has a new kid, it's like there's this magic house in my heart that rearranges to make a new room for the baby. And it always hurts. It's terrifying. One more person who needs you. One more tiny hand with your heart in its grip. I draw a breath, steeling myself. Can I tell you something? Another secret. He turns on to his side, peering at me through the light.
Are we back on who killed JFK?
I shake my head. I think Libby's getting a divorce. His brow creases.
You think?
She hasn't told me yet, I explain. But she's not answering Brendan's calls, and she's not sleeping well. She hasn't had trouble with that since... Charlie's presence has once again uncorked me. He wraps my focus around him in a way that makes it hard to think forward, to be on guard against every possible scenario. Or maybe it's because he really is so organized and thorough, it's easy to believe that he could fix anything with the sheer force of his will, so it feels safe to unbolt all these chaotic feelings.
Since your mom passed away?
He finishes my sentence for me. I nod, run my fingers over the cool pillow between us. The only thing that's ever really mattered to me is being sure she has what she needs. And now she's going through something life-changing, and I can't do anything. I mean, she hasn't even told me about it. So, if anyone's useless... His hand glides up my back, a light, soothing trail over my spine, and settles beneath my hair.
Maybe, he says. You're already doing what she needs you to do, just by being here with her.
I cut him a look, feeling a lift and swell in my heart. Maybe that's all your dad needs from you, too. He gently squeezes my neck, then lets his hand fall away.
The difference, he says, is Libby asked you to be here. He asked me not to.
Well, if that's all you need, I say quietly, like it's a secret. Charlie, will you please be here? He leans forward, softly kissing me, his fingers fluttering over my jaw as I breathe in his minty breath and warm skin. When he draws back, his eyes are melted gold, my nerve endings quivering under them.
Yes,
he says, and pulls me into him, his arm coiling around me and chin tucking against my shoulder.
I already told you, Nora.
He murmurs, his fingers splaying on my stomach, just beneath my shirt.
I'll go anywhere with you.
Sometimes, even when you start with the last page and you think you know everything, a book finds a way to surprise you. 25.
Why do your hands smell like that?
Libby demands as I guide her through the back door, palms pressed over her eyes.
My hands do not smell, I say. It's like new TV smell, she says.
That's not a thing, I tell her.
Yeah, it is. New TV smell.
You mean new car smell?
No, she says. It's like when you open the TV box and pull the styrofoam packing sheet out and it smells like a swimming pool inside.
Then why wouldn't you just say I smell like a swimming pool?
Did you buy us a big-ass TV?
You know what? Forget the grand reveal. I release my hold on her, and she screams. Charlie jolts like she just chucked a priceless vase his way.
Sissy!
She yelps, spinning toward me, then back.
Charlie!
Then to me again.
We're camping?
I shrug. It's on the list. She throws her arms around me and lets out another high-pitched shriek.
Thank you, Sissy,
she murmurs.
Thank you.
Anything for you, I tell her. Over her shoulder, I lock eyes with Charlie. Thank you, I mouth. His chin dips as he smiles. Anything for you, he mouths. In my chest, something heavy turns over. I wake up twice, gasping for breath.
The second time, Libby rolls over, flopping her arm around me in her sleep, her leg twitching so that she's kind of kicking me. Even with the strategically positioned fans, it's uncomfortably warm, but I don't shake her off. Instead, I lay my hand over hers and squeeze her to me. "I will take care of you," I promise her. "I won't let anything hurt you." For once, I get up first. I skip my run and head straight for a shower, then preheat the oven. The corn lime cookies are ready by the time Libby's up, and we eat them for breakfast with coffee.
"You are just full of surprises," Libby says, and pretends not to notice that the cookies are lumpy and burned at the edges.
In this scenario, my cookies are definitely the bad drawing with the penis hat, but I don't care. She's happy about them. On my walk into Good Books, Frigid's final pages arrive. The last stretch has officially begun. When Charlie and I aren't in the same room, we're emailing about the manuscript. When we're not emailing about the manuscript, we're texting about everything else. On Tuesday, when I bite the bullet and order a salad from Papa Squats, I send him a picture of the cubed ham monstrosity Amaya drops in front of me. "I think I underestimated your sadomasochistic streak, Stevens," he says. The next day, he sends me a blurry shot of the bickering geriatric couple from Town Hall caught in a passionate embrace outside the new Dunkin' Donuts. "Love conquers all, I guess," he writes. I reply, "Or she's found a discreet way to suffocate him." "What a beautiful, twisted brain you have, Nora." He stops by one night with the wood Sally promised us, along with s'mores supplies, and helps us build a fire the night is technically too hot for. While we sit around the deck roasting marshmallows, Libby announces,
"I've decided I like you, Charlie."
"I'm honored," he says.
"Don't be," I tell him. "She likes everyone." She reaches into the bag of marshmallows and flings one at me.
"Not true," she cries. "What about my vendetta against the guy in the Trivago commercials?"
"One unpleasant sex dream does not a vendetta make," I say.
"I once had a sex dream about the green M&M,
Charlie says bluntly, and Libby and I descend into snorting laughter.
"Okay," Libby says when she recovers. "But she can get it. She's fucking gorgeous."
"Fucking gorgeous,"
Charlie agrees, locking eyes with me over the flames.
"So much better than adorable."
We make plans to finish our notes on the final portion of the book on Saturday. Every moment until then feels like part of a countdown. Sometimes all I want is to run down the clock. Sometimes I want to stuff sand back up through the hourglass's neck. He texts me things like, "Holy shit, page 340, and "She's on fire," and "The cat." I write back things like, "I screamed, her best yet, and the cat stays," to which he replies, "Agreed." Sometimes he sends me texts that just say, "Nora." "Charlie," I type back. Then he'll say, "This book," and I'll say, "This book." "It's killing me not knowing how it ends," I tell him. "It's killing me that it's going to end," he writes back. "If I weren't editing it, I wouldn't finish it." "Really?" I write. "You have that level of self-control?" "Sometimes." After a moment, he sends another message. "They're a full series I love, whose last chapter I've never read. I hate the feeling of something ending." Instantly, my heart feels raw, rug-burned, every inch of it stinging. This book, this job, this trip, this never-ending, days-spanning conversation. I want to make it all last, and I need to know how it ends. I want to finish it, and I need it to go on forever. If I thought I was sleeping badly our first 2 weeks here, week three obliterates the notion. Charlie and I text until at least midnight each night, sometimes interspersed with quick calls to talk through plot points that leave me so energized that I have to walk a loop in the meadow to cool down.
All these years spent thinking that I had superhuman self-control, and now I realize I just never put anything I wanted too badly in front of myself. But I've made it to Thursday night, which means there's only 2 days until we finish the edit letter. A week and some change until I go back to the city, where the future we've agreed not to discuss will begin. This interlude will be over. The future will be the present, and this will become the past. But not yet. 26. Libby and I walk to the fence line with celery, carrots, and sugar cubes, but even with our best baby talk, we can't coax the horses over. You think they know we're city people? I say.
They can still smell dry bar all over you, she replies.
I cup my hands around my mouth and shout out across the dusky pasture, "This isn't the end! We'll be back!" We hike back to the cottage, then decide we're too hungry to cook and instead trek into town, destined for Papa Squat's loaded fries and cauliflower wings. On the whole walk, Libby's a little shaky. Beneath the street lamps, she's past the realm of peaked and into the territory of straight-up ghostly. Behind the glow of Good Books windows, Charlie's closing up.
"Let's invite him to dinner,"
she cries, unlatching herself from me and leading the charge across the street. Despite our early efforts at discretion, I'm positive she's noticed the vibe between us, but she's kept any disapproval to herself ever since Charlie helped with the surprise campout. She pounds on the shop door with the ferocity of an FBI agent on TV until Charlie reappears, looking exactly how he always looks. Tidy, overworked, well-dressed, and like he wants to bite my thigh.
"We came to invite you to dinner."
Libby pushes inside, beelining toward the bathroom, as she is wont to do these days, calling,
"We're going to Papa Squat's."
"Maybe you've heard of it," I say. It was on a very exclusive BuzzFeed list. Slow nod, dark, gut-melting eyes. Holding his gaze feels like public indecency.
"Places that sound like they'll definitely give you diarrhea, while really they only just might give you diarrhea."
"That's the one," I agree. He widens the door for me, but just then my phone rings. On instinct, I check it. Sharon's calling, while on maternity leave. I should take this. Libby does a cartoon screech to halt and turns back to me.
"No work calls after 5,
she reminds me. "This is different," I say, the ringing scritching against my nerves like fingernails on a chalkboard. "It might be important." Libby's lips fall into a straight line.
"Nora,
just give me a minute, Libby," I say. Her eyes go wide at the sharp edge to my voice. "I'm sorry, I have to do this." I take off down the dark block, heart thudding as I answer the call. "Sharon, is everything okay?"
"Hi, yes," she says brightly. "Everything's fine. Sorry to worry you. I just had a question."
The tension in my shoulders dissolves. "Sure, how can I help?"
"I can't give too many concrete details," she starts, "but Loja might be hiring a new editor soon."
"Oh?" The floor of my stomach sinks. I've gotten enough of these calls over the years to know where this is going. Sharon's leaving, or rather, not coming back from parental leave.
"Yeah," she goes on, "looks that way. And hey, I know you're doing great at the agency, so this might not be interesting to you at all, but I've been talking with Charlie, and he says you're really helping get Dusty's book into shape."
"He makes it easy," I say, and she does too.
"Of course," Sharon says, "but you've also always had a knack for this kind of thing. I guess I'm wondering if there's any chance you'd be interested."
"Interested?"
"In editing," she says. "For Loja."
I must be stunned into silence for longer than I realize, because Sharon says,
"Hello? Did I lose you?"
My mouth's gone dry. It comes out small.
"Here."
This must be how people feel when their water breaks,
like they've been carrying a new future around inside themselves, and suddenly it's gushing out, ready or not.
You want me to be an editor?
I'd like you to interview, yes, she says. But I totally understand if you're not interested. You've made a name for yourself as an agent, and you're great at it. This might not make sense for you. I open my mouth. No sound comes out. I'm stumped. I don't need a concrete answer yet, she says. But if you're at all interested, I expect to have to swim through the soup of my thoughts and feelings, to have to give a hacking cough to get out some words. Instead, I hear my voice as if through a tunnel. Yes. Yes, Sharon says. You'll meet with us? I squeeze the bridge of my nose as pressure rushes into my skull. This isn't the kind of decision you just make, least of all when your sister's in the middle of a potentially very expensive crisis.
I'd like to think about it, I backtrack. Can I call you in a couple days?
Of course, she says. Of course, this would be a big decision. But I'll admit, when Charlie said you might be interested, I was very excited. I barely hear the rest. My mind has become one of those FBI corkboards with zigzagging red string between every pushpin it can find, trying to make things add up, to make all of it fit into one uninterrupted pattern, proof that this can work, that I can have this, that it's not too good to be true. When I hang up, I sit on a bench beneath a street lamp, waiting for the days to fade. After 6 full minutes, I still feel like I'm inside a fishbowl, everything surreally bent and distorted around me. When I finally walk back, the bells over the shop door seem to chime from miles off. But Libby's voice is close and jarring.
There you are, finally!
With obvious annoyance, she adds,
Can we go to dinner now, or do you have a board meeting to get to?
I feel brittle, stretched too far in too many directions, and when she rolls her eyes, something in me finally snaps.
Can you not do that, Libby? Not right now.
Do what? She says. You said you'd be fully present after 5, and
stop!
I lift a hand, trying to hold off the fresh onslaught of red string and pushpins raining down on me, reality crashing in from every direction. Because even if I want this job, I can't have it. Just like I couldn't last time. But at least then, Libby told me what she was going through. At least I wasn't throwing darts in the dark, hoping they'd plug up the holes of a sinking ship.
What's going on with you?
She demands, brow lifted, face torqued with dismay. An unstoppable wave rises through me.
Me? I repeat. I'm not the one sneaking around, disappearing, not answering her husband's texts, keeping secrets. I've been fully present, Libby, all month, and you're still keeping me in the dark.
My pulse feels erratic. My fingers tingle.
I can't help if you don't tell me.
I don't want your help, Nora.
She pales at the thought, sways between her feet.
I know I used to rely on you a lot, and I'm sorry for that, but I don't want to be another excuse for you not to have a life.
Oh, right, I fume. I don't have a life. The only thing that matters to me is my career. Guess what, Libby? If that were true, I'd be an editor right now. I wouldn't have passed on the job I actually wanted to make sure you could afford the best fucking doula in Manhattan.
Her face is white now, her brow damp.
Wait, you...
Her breath is shallow. She turns, setting one palm on the counter. Her other hand rises to her forehead, eyes fluttering closed. She shakes her head, gathering herself.
Libby?
I take a half step toward her, my heart in my throat. That's when she collapses. 27. I catch her, but I'm not strong enough to hold her up.
Help!
I scream as we slump to the ground, the worst of her fall softened. The door to the office flings open, but I'm still shrieking help, screaming like it's doing anything, as if just shouting the word has power. Action over inaction, movement over stagnation, an illusion of control. Charlie comes running, crouches beside us.
What happened?
I don't know, I say. Libby! Libby! Her eyes slid open, flutter closed again. God, she's pale. Was she that pale all afternoon? And her heart is racing. I can feel it shivering through her. Her hands are icy. I take one between mine, rubbing it. Libby. Libby? Her eyes open again, and this time she looks more alert.
Let's get her to the hospital, Charlie says.
I'm okay,
she insists, but her voice is shaky. She tries to sit up. I pull her back into my lap. Don't move. Just take a second. She nods, settles into my arms. Charlie's on his feet already, headed for the door.
I'll pull my car up.
Charlie is the one who talks to the receptionist in complete sentences when we arrive. Charlie is the one who pulls me away when I start half shouting at the nurse who tells us we're not allowed through the doors Libby's ushered through. He is the one who pushes me into a chair in the waiting room, takes hold of my face, and promises it'll be okay. You can't know that, I think, but he's so sure that I almost believe him.
Just sit right here, he says. I'll figure this out.
7 minutes later, he returns with decaf, a prepackaged apple fritter, and the number of the room Libby's been moved into.
They're running tests. It shouldn't take long.
How did you do that? I ask, voice hoarse.
I was on the high school paper with one of the doctors here, he says. She says we can go and wait in her hall until the tests are over.
I've never felt so useless, or so grateful not to be in charge. Thank you, I croak. Charlie nudges the fritter toward me.
You should eat something.
He ferries me through the hospital, stopping by another vending machine for a bottle of water, then to a pair of hideously outdated chairs in a hellishly lit hallway that smells like antiseptic.
She's in there. If they're not out in 5 minutes, I'll find someone to talk to, okay?
He says gently.
Just give them 5 minutes.
Within 20 seconds, I'm pacing. My chest hurts. My eyes burn, but no tears come. Charlie grabs me, pulls me in around his chest, and wraps a hand around the back of my head. I feel small, vulnerable, helpless in a way I haven't for years. Even before Mom died, I wasn't much of a crier. But when Libby and I were kids and I was upset, there was nothing that could make me tear up faster than having Mom's arms wrapped around me. Because then, and only then, I knew it was safe to come apart. My sweet girl, she'd coo. That's what she always called me. She never did the, you're okay, don't cry thing. Always, my sweet girl, let it out. At her funeral, I remember tears glossing my eyes, the pinprick sensation at the back of my nose, and then, beside me, the sound of Libby breaking, descending into sobs. I remember catching myself holding my breath like I was waiting, and then I realized I was waiting. For her, for Mom to put her arms around us. Libby was crumbling, and Mom wasn't coming. It was like a collapsed sandcastle leapt back into place inside me, rearranging my heart into something passably sturdy. I wrapped my arms around my sister and tried to whisper, "Let it out." I couldn't get the words past my lips. So instead, I dropped my mouth beside Libby's ear and whispered, "Hey." She gave a stuttering breath, like, "What?" "If Mom had known how hot the Reverend here is," I said, "she probably would have made it down here sooner." Libby's saucer eyes looked up at me, glazed with tears, and my chest felt like a can being crushed, until she let out a scratchy jolt of laughter, loud enough that Hot Reverend stumbled over his next few words. She lay her head on my shoulder, turned her face into my jacket, and shook her head.
"That is so fucked up," she said,
but she was shaking with teary laughter. For that second, she was okay. Now, though, when she really needs me, I'm useless.
"Why couldn't we be in the room for tests?" I get out.
Charlie inhales, shifting between his feet.
Maybe they think you'll give her the answers.
There is absolutely no conviction in his joke. When I draw back, I realize he's not doing so hot himself. Are you okay? You look like you're going to be sick.
Just don't like hospitals, he says. I'm fine.
You don't have to stay. He takes my hands, holds them between our chests.
I'm not leaving you here.
I can handle it. His mouth shrinks, the crease beneath it deepening.
I know. I want to be here.
A group of nurses pass with a gurney, and an ashen cast seeps onto Charlie's face. I scrounge around for something to say, anything else to think about. Sharon called me. His lips press into a knot. She told me you put me up for a job. After a beat, he murmurs,
If I overstepped, I'm sorry.
It's not that. My face prickles. It's just, what if I'm bad at it? His hands skim up my arms until he's cradling my jaw.
Impossible.
My brow arches of its own volition. Because I helped edit one book? He shakes his head.
Because you're smart and intuitive and good at getting the best writing out of people, and you put the work before your ego. You know when to push and when to let something go. You're trustworthy, partly because you're so bad at lying, and you take care of the things that matter to you. If I had to pick one person to be in my corner, it'd be you. Every time. You take care of shit.
With a sharp throb in my chest, my gaze falls to the floor.
Not always. Hey.
Charlie's rough fingers come back to mine. He lifts my hand, brushing his mouth over my knuckles.
We'll figure out what's wrong and do everything we can to fix it.
That fucking list. My chest is too tight to let anything out but a whisper. She's been doing too much. I shouldn't have let her. We slept out in the heat and we've been working on this fundraiser. She should have been resting. Charlie sits, drawing me into his lap, every thought of discretion, of avoiding complication, gone in an instant. I need him, and he's here, I realize, fully, not with caveats or stipulations. His hand slides up the back of my neck, tucked beneath my hair, and I'm wrapped up in him like he's my personal stone fortress, like even if I came apart, nothing could get to me.
Libby makes Libby's decisions, he says. Imagine how you'd react if someone tried to stop you from doing what you want, Stevens.
A hint of a smile tugs at his pout.
Actually, don't imagine it. It's inappropriate to get turned on in a hospital.
I laugh weakly into his chest, another knot unwinding in my own. I missed something. I'm here with her, and Brendan isn't, and... My voice catches. The rest tumbles out painfully. It's my job to watch out for her.
I know it's scary being here, he says. But this is a good hospital. They know what they're doing.
His fingers move in soothing, rhythmic circles against the nape of my neck.
This is where my dad came.
The words, sweet guy, sear through my mind, like the afterimage left behind by the pop of a camera's bulb. That's what Charlie called his father. A sweet guy, the best person I know. What happened? I ask. After a protracted silence, he says,
The first stroke wasn't bad, but this last one, he was in a coma for 6 days.
He watches the progress of his thumb running back and forth over mine. His brow tightens. The day we met, I mistook this expression for surliness, brooding, proof he was as warm and human as a block of marble. Now, all it does is bring out the lost look in his eyes.
This huge, handy guy who can fix anything, build anything, and in that hospital bed, he looked.
He breaks off. I twine my free hand into the hair at the base of his neck.
He looked old, Charlie says.
Then, after a fraught silence,
When I was a kid, all I ever wanted was to be like him, and I wasn't. But he always made me feel like it was okay to be the way I am.
I cup his jaw and lift his gaze. I wonder if he can see every word in my expression, because I feel them tunneling up from the lowest part of my gut. You're more than okay. He clears his throat.
My dad's alive because of what they were able to do for him here. Between them and you, Libby's going to be all right. She has to be.
As if on cue, the doctor, a balding man with a Salman Rushdie goatee and brow, walks out of the exam room.
Is she okay?
I lurch to my feet.
She's resting, he says, but she gave me permission to speak with both of you.
He nods toward Charlie, who stands, tightening his grip on my hand, anchoring me.
What happened?
I ask. In an instant, my mind cycles through every ailment it knows of. Heart attack, stroke, miscarriage. And then it snags. Pulmonary embolism. The words repeat. They echo. They reach back to the beginning of my life and forward to the end of it. This outstretched slinky of a phrase, looping through time, fucking with everything, warping my life in places, ripping through it in others. Pulmonary embolism. The doctor says,
"Your sister is anemic."
The words slam into a wall. Or maybe run off a cliff. That's how it feels, like I've stepped off a ledge and am hovering before the drop.
"Her body is lacking in iron and B12, he explains. "So she's not manufacturing enough healthy red blood cells. It's not uncommon during pregnancy, and especially unsurprising for someone who's already dealt with this issue in a previous pregnancy."
Libby hasn't had this before.
He studies the clipboard in his hands.
"Well, it wasn't as severe, but her levels were definitely low. I spoke with her OBGYN, and apparently your sister was a bit more stable in her first trimester, but they've been keeping an eye on this since the beginning."
My fingers are tingling again. My brain works to clear the smoke and start a checklist, but it's just not happening.
"What do we need to do?"
Charlie asks.
"It's pretty simple," the doctor says. "She'll need to take an iron supplement and eat more meat and eggs, if possible. She'll also want to do the same with B12. We'll get you a printout on the best sources for those, though I assume she'll remember from last time."
Last time. This has already happened. I didn't just miss it once, but twice.
"She'll possibly have to deal with nausea, but having more smaller meals throughout the day should help. I'd like to see her next week to make sure she's doing better, and then after that, she'll need to have regular checkups with her doctor until delivery."
That's manageable. It's fixable. Listable. "Thank you." I shake his hand. "Thank you so much."
"My pleasure."
He smiles, a remarkably warm, patient smile.
"Just give her time to rest. The nurse will let you know when you can see her."
As soon as he's gone, I feel exhausted, like a 1,000-pound weight just lifted off me, but only after hours of carrying it.
"You okay?"
When I look at Charlie, he's blurry. My vision is distorted.
"Breathe, Nora."
He grips my shoulders, taking an exaggerated inhale. I match it. We stay in sync for a few breaths until the pressure releases.
"She's okay."
I nod. Let him pull me into his chest, wrapping me up tight against him. I try to tell him I'm just relieved, but there's no room for words, for logic, reason, arguments. My body's decided what to do, and it's this. Nothing in Charlie's arms. He buries his mouth against my temple. I close my eyes, letting the waves of relief crash over me. Gradually, they draw back, and I'm left floating, drifting in a current of Charlie, his faintly spiced scent, the heat of his skin, the fine wool of his light sweater. A picture of my apartment flickers across my mind, the yellowy red streetlights catching raindrops on my windowpane, the sound of cars slushing past, the radiator hissing against my socked feet, The smell of old books and crisp new ones, and the cologne whose cedarwood and amber notes are meant to conjure up the image of sun-soaked libraries. The creak of old floorboards, the shuffle of footsteps, half-drunken singing as revelers make their way home from the tequila bar across the street, stopping for dollar slices of pizza dripping with oil. I can almost believe I'm there, in my home, where it's safe enough to relax, to undo the brackets of steel in my spine and slip out of my harsh outline to settle. You're not useless, Charlie, I whisper against his steady heartbeat. His hand is still in my hair.
Organized?
I smile into his chest. Something like that, I say. It'll come to me. At the creak of Libby's door, my eyes open. The nurse smiles.
Your sister's ready for you.
28. Libby perches on the bed, already changed back into her purple polka-dotted sundress, and looking thoroughly chastened. A meek smile tugs at her lips.
Hi.
Hi. I close the door and go to sit beside her. After a moment, she says,
Are you okay?
I balk. Libby, I'm not the one who passed out and nearly cracked her skull on an old-timey cash register. Her teeth sink into her lip.
You're mad.
She wrings her hands in her lap.
That I didn't tell you this happened before.
I'm confused. Her eyes dart furtively toward mine.
I'm confused why you didn't tell me you had a chance at an editing job.
It was years ago, I say. On the bottom rung, and the pay was shit. It wasn't all about you. There were a lot of reasons to stay at the agency. She looks at me with watery, sapphire eyes, a wrinkle between her brows.
You should have told me.
I should have, I agree quietly. And you should have told me about all this. Libby heaves a sigh.
No one knew except Brendan. And he wanted me to tell you, but I knew it would freak you out. And it's super common. I mean, my doctor was pretty sure everything would be fine. I didn't want to burden you.
I reach for her hand. Libby, you're not a burden. You're it. You come first. I add lightly, even before my career. And my Peloton. Huffing, she pulls her hand from mine.
Do you know what kind of guilt that comes with, sissy? Knowing you'll drop everything to manage my life? That you'd give up on your dream job to mother me? It makes me feel incapable.
I just want to be there for you, I reason.
I shouldn't always come first, Nora, she says softly. And neither should your clients.
Fine, I say. From now on, my bagel guy comes first, but you're a close second.
I'm being serious. Mom expected too much from you.
What does Mom have to do with this? I say.
Everything.
Before I can argue, Libby continues.
I'm not saying I blame her. She was in an impossible situation, and she did a fairly amazing job with us. But that doesn't change the fact that sometimes she forgot whose job it was to take care of us. Lib, what are you? You're not my dad, she says.
Since when has that been on the table? She huffs again, grabbing my hands.
She treated you like her partner, Nora. She treated you like you were, like it was your job to take care of me. And I let you after she died, but you're still doing it, and it's too much for both of us.
That's not true, I say.
It is, she replies. I have my own daughters now. And let me fucking tell you, Nora, there are days I get into the shower and sob into a loofah because I'm so overwhelmed. And maybe keeping it hidden from them isn't the answer either, but I can't imagine putting my worries on Tala or B like Mom did to us, especially you. She had it really hard, but she was our only parent, and there were times she forgot that. There were times she treated you like you were an adult.
An icy pang lances through me. Guilt, or hurt, or run-of-the-mill homesickness for Mom, or all of it braided into one icicle right through my heart, burning like only cold can. Like the most precious thing, the only precious thing in my life has frozen over so deeply that there are spider webs of ice veining through me. I wanted to help, I say. I wanted to take care of you.
I know.
She lifts my hands between hers, holding them against her heart.
You always do, and I love you for that. But I don't want you to be Mom, and I definitely don't want you to be my dad. When I tell you something's going on, sometimes I just want you to be my sister and say, "That sucks," instead of trying to fix it.
The distance between us, the trip, the list, the secrets. I've seen all of these as little challenges to overcome, or maybe tests to prove I can be the sister Libby wants. But Charlie is right. All she really wants is a sister. Nothing more, nothing less.